Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Maritime Vicissitudes of the Great Siege. This talk is delivered by Mr. Joseph Muscat.
Good evening to all. I hope I make myself understood. I am going to concentrate on the Turkish involvement as regards ships and the fleet of the Ottomans, right, more than anything else. We'll just touch on the fleet of the order, but it was a minimal thing as regards the great siege of Malta. And before anything else, we have to keep in mind that this was a major amphibious operation, maybe one of the greatest in the Mediterranean. Nothing to do with Lepanto, as that was a great battle between galleys. But this is an amphibious operation. It involved so many facets of landing crafts, attack by sea, etc., etc. And more than anything else, the involvement of the fleet to carry the thousands of people from Turkey to here. That's why we call it an amphibious operation. And as an amphibious operation, we have to keep in mind that it included great complications between the heads of the squadrons, between the land Mustafa and Piali, the great admiral of the fleet. And when there are these complications, there are also jealousies and whatnot. And you can just imagine these chiefs talking together as if we're going to give him a stroke of the stiletto, because no one liked anybody else to intrude on his own capacity as a leader. And this calls for another... Thank you. This calls for another... just think what it involved. One of the facets of the amphibious operation, to take these kayaks, please, not ships, not galleys. Some years ago, an American lady came here. She was an underwater archaeologist, and she wanted to search for the Turkish galleys that were sunk in the Great Harbor. That's not true. They weren't galleys. They were simply great launches, yes, or a sort of kayaks, which were carried by hand on land at the Marsajan, from the Maysamshet harbor to the Grand Harbor. And I will have time to come to this later on. This was not a unique occasion for the Turks. They did it, but I can't remember the exact date, when they carried by hand galleys, yes, from the Mediterranean into the Suez. They did it. But not here, the one in Malta. It only involved great, we can call them barges, kayaks, you can call them whatever you want. A facet of the Great Siege, which was a great amphibious operation. A great one, not a small one. You just imagine our friend Piali Pasha, the head of the fleet. He was responsible for all ships. Now, you may know what sailing a ship involves. People, ammunition, guns, the rowers themselves. And Piali was the head. This is one of the galleys of the Turks. Even the Barbary horses used this type of galliota. They were gorgeously decorated at the at the poop, little armament. They were quite fast and light too. Overcrowded with rowers and other soldiers. Now, I hate to say this. A few years ago, in 2004, a young Turkish girl living in the United States was here and wrote her thesis about the maritime history of Malta. When she referred to the Great Siege, she said it was an insignificant operation by the Turks. Now we'll see how insignificant it was. I hate to say this. At first I thought I am biased against her. But lately, an article appeared in Germany. I don't read German, but our friend Fleury told me about it. He was adamant against this Attaus, who wrote that the Great Siege was just a little operation, as if a punitive operation by the Turks against the Knights of St. John. My God. You will see the thousands involved in this operation. For example, Piali, that's why I mentioned him, had the headache of all ships. When they left Navarino on the 12th of May, Shiawal, was it Shiawal that month? I don't know. The month of May. He was just after 2 days sailing, two of his ships were grounded. And all right, all people were saved, but all gunpowder carried was lost because it got wet, you know, through sea water. Now this is only one instance of this bad luck which met the Turkish fleet after leaving Navarino. More than that, 4 galleys and 4 bastardi. Bastardi is nothing. Was a great galley. They call it a bastarda. 4 galleys and 4 bastardi were found to be unfit for the sea. And they were sent back on guard duties in the area of the archipelago. Nothing else. Later on, but we'll come to it later, there was a great ship, merchant ship, which was totally lost. Now, this is only after 2 days sailing from Navarino to Malta. It was a total loss with 600 Spahi who found it. Now, you can see why Piali, was stretching his head with this great operation. Him being the responsible person for the ships of the order. Now we come to see a series of pictures showing why the Great Siege was an amphibious operation. This type of picture is in a castle at Castan. These are copies from D'Aleccio. I don't know about it. These are found in a castle in France. Lately, Madame Honor Frost, she was visiting the place and she took some photos. They are not quite, but you will see how the galleys of the Turks were involved as an amphibious operation. They are attacking St. Elmo from the sea. Now, you may say that was a very daring action by the Turks, firing by their frail galleys against St. Elmo. But you have to keep in mind that during the first 10 minutes of the final surge to get beneath the firing range of the upper guns, there was some danger for the galleys. But as soon as you get under, guns on St. Elmo couldn't be fired lowering their range downwards. Guns that couldn't do that. So once they got underneath the fire range of St. Elmo, they could fire at Twilina. But that's why we call it another amphibious operation. This thing was not repeated anywhere else during the siege. If it was important or not, but if nothing else, It was a sign of the power of the Turks that they were attacking by land and by sea. another facet of the amphibious operation, we see how these small boats, you call them whatever you like, barges, kayaks, attacked the famous attack on Senglea, on Senglea Point. You will notice how it was literally a carnage. Out of 40, I think the majority were blown out of the sea. You can see the very low battery at St. Angelo, how they simply blew out of the sea the barges that tried to go round into that area. But again, there was the chain there. They couldn't do it. They arrived up to Palizzata, those poles driven into the sea, but they met the Maltese swimmers and whatnot. So they tried to go around, but they were stopped by the famous St. Angelo low battery. Again, another amphibious, this is the same one, but as emphasized by the painting in Cassagne in France. It shows the thing there. One important, keep this in mind, because I haven't got another picture, how they use huge type of mortars, or we call them petrieri, because they fired stone balls, not iron balls. Yeah, there you are. It's another, showing the same episode, but by another person. Look at that. Look, for example, for the chain, and for the passage from Virgo to Senglea. That was criticized by somebody, but there you are. Senglea was saved on several occasions by the fresh soldiers coming from Virgo to Senglea, or from Senglea to Virgo. We can see another, look at, for example, this picture, how it shows clearly the amphibious character of the Great Siege. You have the galleys staying there, that you will see them under their awning, a tent. Why? They were not operational. When you see these galleys with this tent on them, that means that they are there, not operational, standing by. But you will see the whole activity of the Turks on land. And at this period, at this time of the Great Siege, most of the galleys, Turkish galleys, were doing nothing. Except, for example, when you see something like this, their rowers would be sent on land to act as diggers, as carriers, and whatnot, and some of them as soldiers also. Our friend Mustafa had specific orders, which were to be read when everything was set. Now, this contrasts well with what was done on the ships of the Order of St. John. As soon as the squadron left Malta, the general of the galley squadron would call on his flagship, all captains of galleys, and read out the instructions from the council. Mustafa recalled all heads of the Turkish force and read them how he was in total command of the operations of the Great Sea. That went quite not well with Piali, that he had to to bow his head to the Basha Mustafa. But there you are, that's how things go. And, when the heads are in disagreement between themselves, what would you expect? Piali was responsible for the whole fleet. And before going on, I must mention the debacle of the Spaniards at Gerba in 1560. The Spaniards lost 30 galleys. The Order of St. John was there. But through, I don't know, sheer prowess, you can call it what you may, share expertise at navigation and whatnot, they left that place unhurt. The only squadron of galleys that was unhurt at Djerba. Now what happened? Now notice this. In 1560, the Turkish fleet was at its best. Politically, it controlled the Mediterranean. Spain was in the meantime rebuilding her galleys, which she lost at Djerba. But the Turks were not determined to carry on an attack early after 1560. What happened? Each year that passed, the Spaniards got better, replaced their galleys. They always had their very good their soldiers. Now I do long please. Tercio, so Tercio stan Spagnoli. They were Greda, no? Arquebusiers. They regained their strength. Each year that passed, Turkey lost her opportunity to attack again. But it was felt in the air that somehow or other the Turks will soon attack the central Mediterranean. But nobody dares to mention any place except at the last minute. How do we know that it was in the air? Well, everybody knows that there were spies for Venice in Constantinople. Even Knights of St. John had their own spies in Constantinople. Giorgio Latino, who worked in Zante, kept the if not at that time, but later. But I mean, the Knights of St. John had a series of spies here, there, everywhere, to keep them informed about the movements of the Turkish ships. That means that everybody knew that the Turks would be out on the warpath very soon, somewhere in the middle of the Mediterranean, but nobody dared to say where or how. We know that the Turkish fleet, logistically, could reach from Navarino to Tunis. Now watch this. They could cover all this area, but not further from Tunis that way, because this was the area under the domain of the Spaniards. So, everybody knew that there's going to be an attack, but in the last minute, Lavalette got news that it's going to be Malta. And the Turkish fleet was one of the best, if not the best, in the Mediterranean at that time. Only Spain could oppose it. And the Turks had some good commanders at sea, but they also had the difficulty of recruiting personnel for their galleys. Now, the galleys were the most important part of the Turkish fleet because all merchant shipping was left in the hands of private people who organized the activity of merchandise at sea for the Turks. When I mentioned the loss of this one of these great ships, which could be a Mauna or a great merchant ship, everybody said it was sabotage. You know, that the Christians, that Lavalette with his agents operating in the East, sabotaged this great ship. But nothing was like that. It simply hit a reef and it went down in a few minutes. In the 16th century, during our time, the period, 1565, etc., the Turkish fleet could reach Tunis, but it was clear that their huge fleet could not winter in Tunis, say for 6 or 7 months. There were so many things to be thought of, food, shelter, etc. Everybody knew that if you are wintering in some of these places, like I said, Tunis or Malta, for example, the loss from exposure to the elements was great. Then natural death was anticipated of a number of the Turks. And the possible attack from Spain was always there. Now, we must keep this in mind, because when we come to say just a little bit about Don Garcia, some people do accuse him of not being interested in Malta, but he was crafty. He was working it out like on a chess, you know, waiting to see what the Turks are going to do, to get all information before coming to Malta. Because Spain was there. A possible attack by Spain was always there. So the Turks would not dare to say, sir, for example, for on a 6 or 7 months siege in Malta or in Tunis or anywhere in the middle of the Mediterranean, in the central part of the Mediterranean. Most of the ships of the Turkish fleet consisted of, we call them galliotti. But for all means and purposes, Dal Pozzo says clearly that they were galleys. Now, I got this idea also when reading about the Barbary corsairs. They called their galleys galliotta, having just one mark. By the way, this is a Venetian one, but most probably the Turkish ones were like this, because the Turks worked according to Venetian architects, and the manpower was mostly Greek. So this could well be one of the galleys of the Turks also. Mela, as regards the Turkish fleet, Meshihra, we have to say that they were strong, quite light, but they depended on their, what do you call it, leaders. Our three great leaders, I don't know which is which or who is who, Dali Suleiman, who represented the great Sultan, then there were Mustafa and there was Piali. And there were three separate squadrons to attack Malta. The one by the Dali, the squadron by Dali, we call him Suleiman all the same. He had a wonderful galley, which was a capitana or flagship, gorgeously decorated at the stern, and being equipped with white and red striped sails. And this was specially built for Malta, for the attack on Malta. Then we come to the another type of galliotta. Now look at this. Now it is very reliable, because I took this from the works by Opizio Guidotti. You will see here on the bows a sort of small dragon, call it what you may, I don't know what. Somebody calls it a cockatrice. Any further information? What's a cockatrice? I don't know what's a cockatrice. But it's a sort of mythological dragon or something. They used to carry it there. You will see it carrying one lantern, which means that it was a capitana or a leader in a squadron, and using one huge Latin sail. When we come to describe the squadron by Mustafa, I never got a picture of his fabulous galley, but again, it was splendidly decorated at the stern, and Mustafa had his own standard to fly here in Malta as the generalissimo of the Turkish forces and whatnot. When you come to Piyadi Pasha, Dawar of Rasif, please. That's here. That's him showing the standard as a general, the red pavilion of the Turks, showing the red standard of his fleet. Now, some people say that his capitana, his flagship, was equipped with 30 benches on each side. But when you hear other people say 32 benches on each side, and again 35 benches on, this is unheard of. But you know, I have noticed that more books you read about this great siege, the more confusing ideas you get sometimes. Because to have a 35 galley, that means working with 35 benches on each side, that's something out of the blues. I don't know. I cannot understand how it worked with 7 rowers on each bench. You just imagine 7 rowers with shoulders, you know, touching each other. I don't know how it worked. But I'm saying this because it's written by nobody less than Julien de la Gravière, who was a great French captain too. All the great galleys for these three leaders in the great siege had their famous poop cabins gorgeously carved and decorated with the emblem of the crescent. You can see it anywhere. Then with Turkish, I know graphics, I don't know what you call it, lettering in Turkish. And of course, they were all damask, linen, and imbroc. I don't know what to say that in English, imbroc. Not embroidered, lamination. Is there anything to do with the laminat in Maltese? We call it also laminat and imbroc. You can just imagine how lavishly they were decorated, because they were specially prepared for the attack on Malta. To corroborate this, I found some information about our friend Uccelli, thanks to Louis Sherry. He was in Calabria and he photographed this monument to Uccelli. He's got nothing to do with the Great Siege of Malta. But his galley was gilded on the outside, on the internal parts, and even the floor. And this is said by a visitor, by the British visitor, who visited his galley sometime after 1571. This goes to say how these Turks, you know, prepared their galleys for the attack on Malta. When we come to talk about a capitana, a flagship, or a common galley, there you are, these are by Alessio. You will see a common galley painted red, and the capitana painted green with 3 lanterns, but that denotes a royal galley, not just a capitana with 3 lanterns. With 1 lantern, yes. Now we may see them better here. A green hull denoted a capitana, and a red hull denoted a common galley. Now you will see here the number of apertures for the guns. I don't know. This could be an artistic license, because a galley normally never get it more than 5 guns under the rambata. But there you are. Now, whenever you see a green galley, you say either a flagship or somebody in command. You find people, but I'm sorry to say this, I read only Christian Western sources, I can't read Turkish or not, who say that as a general rule, the Turkish galleys were not up to standard when compared with the Western type of galleys. They were not as good and as swift as the Christian ones. There's a lot to say about this. But Erivan, I say this because you come across it in westernized, what do you call them, writers and whatnot. I wanted to include also a note about the instruments carried by the Turkish forces also. Now, instruments were carried not just for the pleasure of music, but most of the time they were signals. And there was the drum, there was the trumpet, and there were others too. For example, you see a trumpet there. When in Malta there was a good Muslim trumpeter, if he cared to teach other slaves how to blow the trumpet, he would be relieved of heavy duties. Apparently, they had the touch or the lips for this trumpet. You know, most of the time they were used for fanfare we call it, fanfara, or signals, or as martial music, as a psychological effect against your enemy. But D'Alessio shows that there these three very, very, very good type of instruments. The great drum, the timbali, like a small kettle drums, normally they were hung here like, and these are not trumpets, they are, Bozio calls them niakere, something between the sweet music of a oboe and the crying of a goat. The niakere couldn't make any other better sound because it was simply made from cane, and the reed made from cane too, niakere. Now listen to this. Our friend Contreras, he was so crafty that on one occasion he entered into the midst of a Turkish squadron, imitating their music on the timbali and on the niakere, and he got out free without any further trouble. And sometimes, even on another occasion, Venetians got mixed up with the Turkish forces at sea because they mistook the sounds given by their instruments. Very well. These were very important instruments at sea, were very important. If nothing else, to install fear into the enemy. I have just mentioned this Constantinople. I just wanted to note that on one occasion, 50 geddes were built in a few months. 50 geddes. They had the people, they had the material, and they had the know-how from Venetian architects and Greek artisans. They had it. If you remember well, after Lepanto, the Turks lost a great number of geddes. In a few months, they constructed another 100. But I don't know, but some historians do seem to forget that building geddes in a great hurry and with unseasoned wood would be better for the building purposes, but not for being seaworthy. But Uccelli was all out, you know, he made a great political, propaganda that, look, Lepanto was nothing to us. We said we've got the Geddes squadron rebuilt. But if those Geddes had to meet an open battle at sea again and had to have the first punch from other Geddes, they would sink easily because they could never withstand, their galleys would never withstand being built with green wood, would never withstand the impact of another galley. But there you are. They had, for example, unlimited limits of prime material for their guns, for example. They had Smyrna and other everywhere else. They had a lot of material, and a lot of material for ship building. I want to repeat this because somebody said that their bows was very low in the water. That gave them the advantage of firing low. But we were going to see, on the contrary, in some of the pictures. And this is a fact that even Venetian galleys carried a how a high bow, so that when firing, they fired in a high parabola, which was a defective way of firing at sea. But it gave them greater sailing properties with the bow how high up from the water. And there you are. We come to a galliotta. Now, I must say this. Now, this dates back to the 1796. This is called a galliotta also. But look, it has got three masts. Now, this is an eyewitness. I found this at Santo Spirito when things were coming in, and I was lucky to come against this just fly leaf. For me, now, it is lost, because I don't know where they put it, but I managed to have a photocopy of it. Now, look at this interesting point. The mast, you can see it here, is being lowered with the help of no one else, no other ship, but it's being lowered through a gears attached to the bows. Look, going down like this. Can you notice this flag here? This belongs to the Moroccan emperor. Now, see what happened. This galliot was tied under one of the ramparts in the in the Grand Harbor, and the representatives of the Moroccan emperor came to Malta to release some slaves, 1,200. Now, this is, you can find this only, I think, in Ryan, except the primary sources. But it seems that the emperor was down with a very serious illness, and he was nearing to die. And he made a vow, I don't know, to Muhammad, I don't know to who, but he said, if he gets well, he will ransom many slaves. He got well, and his representative came to Malta in Deruan's time to ask for the release of these slaves. You know, by this time, 1796, the finances of the order were blah. And when the administrators of the order heard about this proposition, oh, they said, this is a present from heaven. The Maltese clerks who work administrative here, oh, this is a miracle of St. John. Because they got a percentage from each slave that was redeemed. And the slaves themselves, oh, this is a prodigy of Muhammad. And Dublais said, this was an act of piety by a barbarian prince. But anyhow, they were released. Now, we have to keep this in mind. The order asked for a 100 louis, Luigi. They were worth, at the time, Josamu says, about 10 scudi each, for each slave. 100 Luigi. 10% went to the Grand Master. Another percentage to the harbor master, to the Maltese clerks, who did all the red tape. The artisan and the banyos got their fair share too, and they paid for the clothes, food, and for the transport to the various countries. There were great rejoicing in Malta, on every side, even by the slaves themselves. Now we come, I meant to show you a series, now this is the flag of Morocco, complementary, a series of flags from Barbary to try and contrast them with the flags shown in Malta. Carry on, see please, one after the other, look, from Tripoli and from Tunis, another from Candia, and that's from Tripoli, from Algiers, again from Algiers, and Algiers again, this was a combat, a better standard, again from Algiers, and from Algiers. And another one from Tunis of Barbary. And the pavilion, a flag for the Corsairs. Now, just look at all these flags here. No one corresponds with those. Now keep this in mind. These are land forces. They might have had their own colors. You never know. But the ones we saw are the flags carried at sea, and they are by Aubin. He wrote about the end of the 17th century. But this Aubin is a reliable source, and he's got a lot of flags flown by all types of ships in the Mediterranean. Now, the Barbary Galeotta, now, they were crafty. You know that the Barbary Regencies were obliged, whenever the Turkish emperors asked them for help and asked for galleys, they would say, sorry, we've got only few galleys and many galeotti. Now, the difference was that a galeotta carried one mast, and a galley carried two masts. But I want to quote Dal Pozzo again, there was hardly any difference between a galeotta and a galley. Now, the Barbary Corsair did this so that whenever the emperor, Turkish Ottoman emperor, asked for their fair share of the forces, they would say, oh, we've got only few galleys, the rest are galeottas. And so that they would, you know, be spared of helping the Turkish emperor with a lot of their ships. One of their galeotta could carry between 16 and 18 benches on each side, and they would be rowed by two rowers each oar. But there were the greater ones, 18 to 22 banks of oars. They would be rowed by three, by three, what do you call them, rowers. What can we say about the Turkish squadron of galleys? They were there, but most of the time they were not always Turkish galleys, because some of them came from Turkey itself, others from, for example, Rhodes, from Famagusta, and from various places in their area. But they were all called Turkish galleys. When we come to the difference between their galleys, you have to look at the stern. One lantern, or one lantern, distinguishes from the others as being a flagship. If it was a padruna, a second in command, it won't carry one of those. Don't be confused, as this galley is carrying the flags of the author and Turkish flags. This was the case of the Lupa, which was called, caught and brought here in Malta. Now, as a sign of ignominy, what do we call it? When they brought it into Grand Harbor, their colors, you know, were let down into the sea to see the superiority of the order over the Turkish galley. That's why it is like that. Obliyohra, please. Now come to say something about the guns carried. This is just an artist's idea by our friend Francis Gallia, who wanted to show me what he meant by a galeotta, just carrying one gun at the bows, and then a lantern at the... Well, that's a bit, you know, out of normal, but there it is. But, you know, we come to say something about the guns carried. This is taken from Gilmartin. Now, the great guns brought in Malta, there could have been one like this. Might not have been as big as this. That looks to me like the Dardanelli, huge mortar. But they brought one with them, Marluku. Then there were the great basilisk. One of them, for example, was 180 hundredweights. Just imagine. But, of course, these were not carried on the galleys. They were too big. What would have been Geniton Derkelis was this one, the Corsair, the central one, and small ones to the side, even this one. They carried even a small Falconetti at the CERN. But they were only there, you know, against borders, not to fire against ships. Most of the time they were all smoke and sound, but not effective. Anyhow, that was most of the time, most of these guns at sea. They were only fired as a defiance and whatnot. Then we come to another type of galley. These are earlier pieces of ordnance depicted by Gentilini. You will see, for example, a very wide bore, firing stone bore. They were very effective, but very hard to produce them, as they were all, you know, shaped by hand. Then there was the Braga small gun, another common galley. This is a breech loader, which we call. It's open here at the back. You put the musclu, even the Maltese, we say muscly. You put there, and they are a sort of preloaded. You'll charge, say, half a dozen of these by you, and you simply put it in, press it against the barrel, and fire it. Work with firing, but they could only be used with small bores or mitralia, or what you call them, pellets. They couldn't fire, for example, against swords. Then there was an experimental type being charged from the back and not from the fore part of it. And another type of great carrier incaponato, incamerato, because the charge chamber was different from the normal anima, normal bore of the gun. The galleys bore also small guns on the sides, which we call them sometimes falconetti, sometimes swivel guns. You see this model in the Maritime Museum. And another type of small gun, which you can see this also in the Maritime Museum, small swivel guns, most of the time. More noise than they would do any harm to other ships. You will see one, this is not Turkish, by the way, you will see one the normal usage on Geddes, using just three guns on the bows. And of course, there used to be also, which we call it tromboncini, I think it could be translated as blunderbusses. And there were also falconetti small guns. We come to the people involved in this great siege, which our girl Atos said it was just a simple operation. I am quoting from Balbi. There were 6,300 Janizari. The Sultan used to call them my children, the same number he kept in Constantinople for his security. There were 6,000 Spahi, 5,500 from Romania, Spahi again, 2,500 Spahi from Greece, 500 from Turkey, another 500 from Turkey, 500 from Mytilene, I don't know what you call it in English, the small island of Mytilene. 1,000 Levantine, a general expression meaning the East, and 13,000 Dervisi, those who are suicide school. Anyhow, they were there to do all the shouting and all the yelling. Balbi says there were at least 80,000 Turkish forces. Yes. But don't forget that sea people only, sailors, there were 48,000 to men the ships. The Order of St. John had only 6,100, according to Balbi. Don't forget, when we said this round figure of 80,000, they include all the merchant shipping personnel. There were a lot of Jews with them, to do business. That's always, it was always like that. There were a lot of merchants. There were at least 200 merchant ships with this let's call it a small force. 200 merchant shipping. Now just think, we'll be able to mention something. All the material that had to be carried here for the Great Siege. We can see the Janissaries here, they were sharpshooters, and they proved themselves here in Malta too. When we call about the Spahi, they were specialists in firing the bows and arrows. Their bows were specially made from, what do you call them, bone, and it took months to produce one of these special arches. And they also had with them the famous, they were lancelotti also. Apart from the spears, they also operated with their lances. There were also, there you are, most of these spies and whatnot, and laborers and slaves from the galleys were used to do all the carrying. God knows the material different they carried on place. Now, just have a look at this type of galleys. Now you see simply overcrowded with personnel, and they were like this. And now note, for example, the Turkish galleys with their high bows. But on other pictures, we saw them having low bows. I don't know how to interpret this, but difference with the Venetian ones, look, their bows are much more lower than the Turkish ones. Anyhow, these galleys carried a huge number of personnel on board. How they managed, I don't know. I know, for example, on Maltese Capitana of the 18th century carried at least 800 personnel on a Capitana, on a flagship. How they lived, I don't know. Maybe by that time they never had a lot of fighting against the Turks, but there you are. A common galley would have 500 men on board. I mentioned the Bastarda or the heavy galley. Now this was carried by, this was a Basha would sail on such a galley. Notice the bows here. That was what we can call a dispensable spear. Now, I know a story that happened at Zabar. At one time, Castelnuovo on his Sultana was operating near Rhodes. A squadron of 18 galleys attacked him. But he had a lot of hand grenades on board. Small, but they were effective. Three of his galleys went in for the kill and entered with their spear in the Tartana. But being met with a lot of hand grenades, the Turks had to back out of the action. Another and another went in, three of them. And all the time, they left this spear in the heart, stuck there in the heart. Castelnuovo won the day, he came to Malta, and offered these three iron spears as an ex voto to the Zabar sanctuary. Now, I heard this from our friend Carmelo Bonavia, who told me he knew someone who said that at one time these three spears were lying there in the Zabar sanctuary as an ex voto. But one certain sacristan said, oh, this is rubbish, all rusted and whatnot, and he threw them away. No. There you are. That's the only case I know of dispensable spears on a Turkish galley. Then there was again the famous Galiotta. This is the picture taken from Guidotti again, and one can see the proportion. He's quite good, this officer Guidotti. This is their Turkish Galiotta. Now, they compare well with the galleys of the order, Now just look what the galleon of the order was, a huge thing, you know. And even the caramusar, which was much greater. Then there was the fregata, there was the germa and the saika. They had the navio also, and the petacchio too. But as a galliotta, it was just a small ship. But they were effective also, and they operated a lot with such things. When we come to talk about a royal galley, I couldn't find one in Allacho's drawings, except for the one we saw before, having the three lanterns on the poop, denoting it as a royal galley. For example, the one for the Lee Suleiman must have been one like that, otherwise he wouldn't show his rank. Now look at this. Couldn't be better to see how the Turks operated in Malta. You have the great ships that were brought in, Muslim Shed, a lot of their galleys doing nothing and moored under their awning, under their under their tents, and the few galleys outside the Grand Harbor, but even those are not doing anything. Why? The sails are down, are fair, and they've got also awning on them. Now just imagine, because we'll come to this again later on, the great ships that carried the huge amount of provisions that the Turks required for Malta. We come to say something about the rowers on galleys. It was simply a dog's life working on the galleys of the Order of St. John or anywhere else. And when the galleys were busy, see please, when the galleys were busy, there was no rest for these galley slaves. You will see here how on a Christian galley, you would find the Bonavoglio keeping his moustache, then a Moor, and others. Normally they have a small besbouza here, denoting him for a Turkish slave. Now, these people worked there and lived there day and night in the open on one small bench, not being more than 2 meters and 1 meter wide. And they were always shackled by their left foot to the... If a galley went down, they would go down with it. Let's have a look now at quickly what we call the Barbary Regencies, which is Tripoli, Tunis, and Algiers. These had their part in the preparation for the attack of Malta. But Dragut was not here from the start. And that was a God-sent benefit for us, because he had more ideas how to attack Malta than the others. We're going to say, and I do apologize for the poor, but these are taken from Tervais, 1522, the Tervais, 1522-26, you see? Tervais, the word by Tervais. Tervais, his work on maps and whatnot. Cartographer. 1520s. But I had to enlarge these pictures a lot, that's why they look so bad. But he gives us a good idea how their ships were like, you know. Abba Zuhra, another great ship, this could be a Mauna. I'm not so sure how to picture this Mauna, but there you are. Nopsia, Kenyon Oz. Ili? Moftem? Moftem Nish, you know. You know, Tlaquara Nopsia, Ili, Nif, sorry. Our friend Idris Botsan sent me this picture. But you see, now this is the trouble with foreigners. Now, he translated this one as a galleon. It's an inconsistency. Now, this is a great advantage for us when we want to have a regular translation of the things. We come up again, this one, drawn by what our friend Schelling's, yes, 1664-65 was here. Here he shows one of the great guns here on the upper Caracas. Now again, this shows up in a Mortier map, but Dr. Ganado was telling me this Mortier, this is a 1705. But he copied from one and another, it goes down to Aleccio again. You see, I used to think that at least up to 1705, this great gun was here. But that's not the truth, because he simply copied from Tenkyo. Then again, greater ships. And you know what these great ships carry, do? A galley could not carry anything serious, because most of the hold was taken by the captain's quarter for the night, biscuits, an important partition for the wine drinkers, anybody who could afford it, who could buy a little wine. Then the room of Santa Barbara, then a place for the sails and whatnot, and cordage, and a small place for casualties. Therefore, on a galley, there was no space enough to carry all the material that was. And our friend appears again. I want to give you just a small idea what was carried here in Malta by the great ships of the Turks. Their famous bombs. All type of metal. What do you call a forges for working on metal when needed? All type of wood. They knew that they wouldn't find the necessary wood here. All type of tools for digging of mines. And what not? There's, for example, I calculated that as regards gunpowder, they carried at least 5 million pounds of it. 15,000 hundredweights or 25 hundredweights. Powder for the arquebuses only. You know that even powder for the mines was a special one. So they had to think of everything, because they knew they could not find anything here in Malta. And we come to our friend, a type of the, what we call it, recruitment of people for their ships. There was the one, he must be Maltese, no, this was, I don't know, could hear him swearing, you know. There was a type of one rower to be selected from 20 or 30 families. This is in the Turkish region. So, and the rest pay for his maintenance, for his and whatnot. Then there was another type of Lohra, who was the bonavoglia or volunteers to work on the Turkish ships. They were guaranteed food and something small for their pockets. Then of course there were the Christian slaves. But something very interesting, the Christian Turks were not the majority. In 1560, out of 130 galleys, there were 40 manned by slaves, 30 by volunteers, bonavoli, and 60 by people taken up by a sort of conscription. One day, Barbarossa complained that he said, "Poor me, I have been supplied with rowers from Serbia and Bulgaria who saw the sea for the first time in their life when they came on my galleys." You can just imagine the consequences when people are not used with the sea. But there you are. And sometimes the soldiers helped the rowers. There were the great ships, Turkish great ships. This is the famous galleon this is an ex voto in Zabar. Now, there's this sword that was taken, and this was one of the last straws which made the Sultan decide to come to Malta and attack it. Now, Ettore Rossi is said to have seen this this ex voto when it was dated 1565. This is written in pencil, but again, it has been restored by cutting off the upper part of the ex voto. Anyhow, it said this is the that I don't know. I can't believe it. But you see it there. has been during the siege was moored against Virgo. We find a lot of ships, for example, the Karamusal, Ohra, these are different ideas taken from different sources of the Karamusal. Was a principal merchant ship. Then we come again, to the Saika. There used to be dozens and dozens of these ships taken by the garrison of the Order of St. John. And as I said, I repeat this, it wasn't just the 193 garrison that came to Malta that constituted the siege of Malta, but there were another 200 such merchant ships to take all the provisions for the siege. This is another type of Saika, Komprohra, and this is another Saika. And we come to the Germa. These are all types of merchant shipping taken. These were taken, you know, by the dozens, by the ships of the order. But they were all present here, Meshi. And you come to the Brigantine, again, the Maltese Brigantine and the Turkish Brigantine, where they say. This was a very popular type of small ship in the Mediterranean. Anytime the ships of the order went on some amphibious operation around the Mediterranean, they always take a lot of these to carry, for example, ladders and provisions. They were always important, naturally. We come to the 18th of May, when the Turks arrived in Malta. Now, this is something queer, which I never understood. Balbi says that they came here just under their foresail. The main sail was lowered. I don't know. This is the Battle of Lepanto, by the way. But it's interesting to see how the devil blew in their favor. we see another time. Look, it's repeated here by the lecturer. And my God, this could have never happened. The galleys are so close to each other. Eyewitnesses say, according to Balbi, that the ships were first seen on the horizon. They covered all the horizons when the ships were still 30 miles away from Malta. And you can see them here utilizing both sails. Our friend Romegas was there just defying that mighty armada against him. But of course, that issue included this. And now, this is very curious. Our friends from Kasani didn't include the Romegas fleet here, anyhow. Merci. Again, I have included this one to show that the all the Turkish galleys and armada were led by one small galliotta who sat in front of everybody else doing the sounding of the depth of the sea. Not. And that was a very important thing. When they went near Merseyslav, they couldn't land here because there was east Grigar Bilponin. East-northeast wind. So they could not stick at Merseyslav. So they went around the western coast of Malta and hovered here. They moved slowly until they reached Imjar. They moved so slowly, Balbi tells us, that they could count the ship one by one, 193. The first thing they did, they took up water. You can see them here. Look, they left on the 12th. They arrived here on the 18th. That's the maximum logistic length that they could afford to replenish their fresh water supply. The water supply was most important, more than the food itself. So the first thing they did at Imjai, they took on more water. It was important here. And thanks to our commendatore, Salvatore Musuhi, he shows us here how they took fresh water. But I included on my picture without taking permission. I added a small bird here. But that's the way they carried small casks, elliptical ones, that could be carried by just one man. And you just imagine the work involved in replenishing all data. They came here, this is from an old map at Master Schlock, but they never stood there. They disembarked about some 2,000 soldiers, but then carried on to the other part. There they are here. Now, on the 19th, no, on the 20th, midnight on the 20th, they came back to Master Schlock, putting in the place, they put three galleys, 1, 2, 3, to show the place where they could enter into Master Schlock, with a great lanterns lighting on top of the mast. Then, of course, on the 20th, there was a great disembarkment of. Can you say something about the, only just a few minutes, about the squadron of the order? It was simply non-existent. But we know that before, say, even a week before, the galleys were coming and going to Sicily, taking old men and disabled people to Sicily. On the 13th, the galleys of the order carried a small force under Della Cerda. On the 14th, there was the Bagnosco, who brought some mercenaries from Messina. In the afternoon of the 14th May, another Medici brought with him 200 Neapolitans. On the 15th, a great ship from Genova came with a load of wheat. In the afternoon, the captain of the Grand Master brought again 400 soldiers. And Romegas was, you know, posing here, there, and there, with his capitana of the Grand Master, San Gabriele, La Corona, San Giacomo, and San Giovanni. The capitana, Padrone, and one other galley, they were secured in the moat between St. Angelo and Virgo. They were refloated after the great siege. The San Giovanni was too big to be raised there. Then, of course, for a time, the Padrona of the Knights of St. John was hovering around the Barbary Regencies to check when Dragut was ready to come here to Malta. The ships of the order consisted of the Capitano, the Padrona, with me the flagship, and the second in command, La Corona, San Gabriele, San Giacomo, San Giovanni, Capitana and Padrona of the Grand Master, which means he paid for them himself, and the Grand Galleon, Turkish Galleon, caught there. We come to the Piccolo Soccorso on the 8th of July, which is was a great occasion of great luck for the Knights of St. John, or it was timed exactly to come in when the Turks was not paying attention to that part. We see it again as pictured by Cassani. Then we come to the Grande Soccorso. What was our friend Garcia doing? All right, you read modern works, you can easily say this. He was paying attention that the Turks might start losing some soldiers and whatnot, losing their great zeal to continue with the siege, or they were, you know, fighting between themselves as they did. Others say, no, he was a coward, he wouldn't, try. No, he played his cards well. We have to say that. And he came in the nick of time, when the Turks needed that last punch to make them go away from Malta. Anyhow, the great Gandesh Corso was a great success. And of course, when they started to move from Liha downwards, they met nearly with no opposition at all. The Turks packed up hurriedly and went to St. Paul's Bay again to take some fresh water before proceeding on to their neighbors. And have anyone ever sought the great burial place for the Turks, for the thousands of Turks that were buried here, or they were not buried here? There were thousands who were dead here. I don't know. This is something modern. And I have to repeat myself, sorry. This great siege of Malta, according to Athos, was just a simple operation, a punitive action against Malta. My God, all such action and all these people involved for Athos were simply nothing. But she has been by somebody anyhow. Let's hope for the best and hope she reads more about the great siege of Malta. Thank you for your attention.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Maritime Vicissitudes of the Great Siege. This talk was delivered by Mr. Joseph Muscat.